The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Northeast Credit Union,
helping their members save money
through free checking accounts and refinancing of
auto, home, and personal loans.
Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you
to discover the difference at
necu.org.
Federally insured by NCUA.
Equal housing opportunity.
And Dartmouth Hitchcock,
creating a new model for healthcare,
where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us.
A sustainable system,
improving the health of our communities for years to come.
Information at
imagine.d-h.org.
Word of mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Labels get thrown around willy-nilly during primary season. They're tossed off by pundits and placed in attack ads and carefully calculated by campaigns. So when candidate Hillary Clinton snapped this off during the first Democratic debate in October, you can be pretty sure it was well vetted.
Just for the record, are you a progressive or are you a moderate?
I'm a progressive, but I'm a progressive who likes to get things done. And I know how to find common ground.
While Hillary fans cheered, supporters of Bernie Sanders pointed to Senator Clinton's voting record to contest any claim to progressive credentials. But just what does progressive mean in 2016? Yale University history professor Beverly Gage dug into that question for the New York Times Magazine. And Beverly, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you.
So before we get to what progressive means today, let's talk about its history. When was it first used in politics and what did it mean then?
Well, the word progressive has a very long and somewhat tortured history in American politics. It really became popular sort of around the turn of the last century, so from the late 19th moving into the 20th century. This was a moment when a lot of Americans were very worried that kind of new big industrial corporations were taking over American democracy, when people were worried about mass immigration coming into the United States and what that was going to mean for cities and working conditions. And most of all, they were really worried the government wasn't up to the task of dealing with all of these things. So to be a progressive at that moment was just to be someone who said, look, we have these social problems, and we really think that the government at all levels really ought to be doing something about it.
Well, you point out that urban reformers and pacifists and trust busters and suffragists all called themselves progressives. What made it so appealing?
Right. Well, I think it was really a hopeful word at the time, and it was a word that said we have these challenges as a society and we can do something about them. But progressivism had also a somewhat darker side. So you listed off a bunch of groups that we would think of as being more or less progressive today, but a lot of people called themselves progressives at the time that we would now think of as being kind of reactionary. So people who put the Jim Crow system into place, legalized segregation in the South, often described themselves as progressives because they said that black voters and black politicians were corrupt, and therefore, if you wanted a good government in the South, it had to be a white government. So there was all sorts of stuff that fell under this label at the turn of the last century. And this has been really puzzling to historians for just about the whole time since.
Well, and it was that bitter three-way election in 1912, the incumbent Woodrow Wilson, Republican Howard Taft, and Teddy Roosevelt running as the Bull Moose candidate, his ally and old friend Taft.
Right, exactly.
They all claimed progressive status. So if you consider their policies, did a true progressive emerge there?
If you think about the progressive era and you think about a single politician who kind of embodies that progressive can-do spirit, it's really Teddy Roosevelt. And he ran on a party that explicitly called itself the Progressive Party. But in this bigger tent of progressivism, certainly Woodrow Wilson was a progressive. And William Howard Taft, even though Teddy Roosevelt said, you're a conservative, you didn't do what I wanted you to do in the White House, I think he also, by most standards, could be considered a progressive.
Well, this was a huge force at the beginning of the century. We had labor reform, banking reform, the income tax. When did things shift and why?
Well, the end of the progressive era really sort of came around the First World War. So a lot of people who had been so confident that government and rational thought and good planning was going to bring about a better future were pretty upset when the First World War came along. Millions of people died in a massive bloodbath that seemed to really produce nothing. And so that was a real moment of disillusionment. Some people kept calling themselves progressives, but the real energy of the movement ended around that moment.
And the word shifted, I guess, or morphed somewhat during the New Deal and into liberals. Is that when liberal became the term?
That's exactly right. Yeah. So when the 30s comes along and you get a big new burst of reform energy in the government, Franklin Roosevelt enters the White House, most of his crowd are not calling themselves progressives at that point. They've chosen the word liberal. And that's partly because progressives often had this kind of moralistic approach to politics, right? So they were associated with prohibition, for instance, which FDR didn't like at all and got rid of the moment that he was in the White House. So they started calling themselves liberals. And then in the 30s, to be a progressive really meant that you had moved much further to the left, that you were sort of a fellow traveler of the Communist Party.
So when did progressive make a comeback?
So progressive went really sort of out of circulation in the 40s and 50s when you had McCarthyism, when to be really a leftist of any stripe was considered somewhat suspect. And it was pretty dead for a long time. But when liberal, which had been the term of choice, when that became a dirty word, sort of starting in the 70s and 80s with Ronald Reagan, then a lot of people on the left of the Democratic Party went back to progressive and thought, hey, we have this useful term once again.
We're speaking with Beverly Gage. She's a history professor at Yale, and she wrote about the term progressive for the New York Times Magazine. And this is something that, Republicans would probably use as an insult, wouldn't they, progressive?
Yeah, it hasn't been there's so many insults that could be used, liberal, socialist, progressive. I'm not sure that progressive has quite caught on as an epithet yet, though we may be seeing that coming in the election this year.
But it does seem, I think more people in a very anecdotal way would call themselves progressives than liberals. Does liberals still sort of connote a kind of insult, or progressive maybe carries a little bit more positivity or even righteousness?
I think that's right. I mean, I think liberal at this point has both a slightly dated connotation, but I think it also can seem kind of limited to a lot of people. Certainly people still bandy that word around, but really progressive, if you look at the gay rights movement, you look at the environmental movement, you look at the campaign finance movement, I think most people in those movements at this point are calling themselves progressives rather than liberals.
Well, when I heard Hillary Clinton use the term progressive who gets things done, to me, it sounded like part rallying cry and part put down.
Right.
So what's the argument against her calling herself a progressive?
Right. Well, it's a funny phrase, and she really did seize upon it. It got, as you saw, big applause line at the debate. She made bumper stickers with that line. So she's really embracing this phrase. I think it's intended to appeal to people who might be voting for Bernie Sanders in the primaries, but it also has this little put down attached to it, which suggests, progressives are dreamers, right? Progressives are idealists. Progressives have all these big ideas about the future, but they aren't necessarily being realistic. So I think she's really trying to split the difference there and say, I'm a big dreamer, but I'm a realist at the same time, and I'm going to get into the muck of politics and, as she said, get things done.
Well, Beverly, I was looking at a number of the comments, and I know a lot of writers choose not to look at the comments on their articles, but it seems like the term is still very much fraught. There are a lot of sort of barbs from the left that progressive means communist or socialist, and others who say that, I'd rather be progressive than regressive. Why do you think it's such a contentious term?
Well, I think it's contentious because it can mean a lot of different things to a lot of different people. So if you look at someone like Glenn Beck, who I'm not sure has a whole lot of influence on the right anymore. But when he was writing and thinking a lot about people like Woodrow Wilson, you know, he actually was equating progressives with fascists, with people who want to kind of exhibit social control over the whole society. And I do think that that kind of language has sort of caught on the right. Whereas on the left, you know, I think progressive is really a deeply held set of values that conveys what you think about civil rights, about gay rights, about the environment, and about a whole range of issues.
Beverly Gage, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thanks. I really enjoyed it.
Beverly Gage, she's a professor at Yale University and a frequent contributor to the New York Times Magazine. That's where we read her article, More Progressive Than Thou. You'll find a link to read it yourself at wordofmouthradio.org. From anti-bullying seminars to Scared Straight, ushering students into an auditorium or gymnasium for an all-school assembly is a time-honored tradition. But sometimes the purpose of a school assembly can be, well, head-scratching or downright inappropriate. Word of Mouth asked some folks around the station to recall some of their memorable school assemblies. Here's what they had to say.
Sure. So I went to school in a public school in a rural part of Alabama. Really like farm country. Like the school was sort of the only thing in the town. One of the two strong memories of school assemblies I have is of the sex education assembly we had. Basically, it was abstinence only, and it consisted of a sort of string of just the worst kind of horror stories of what STDs could do to you. And then there was a story about soldiers in World War II, and then that they got this disease called gonorrhea, and she said it, you know, would make their testicles swell. And then she said then they'd wake up in the morning, and in order for them to march, and then she like looked at us and like dramatically went, and she said that's why they call it the clap.
My memory of a specific assembly was from when I went to Callanan Junior High, and they had a group of people that came in to tell us about the dangers of popping pimples in the T-zone. I remember thinking at the time, that's not real. But they said that if you popped a pimple in the T-zone, you could get an infection and you'd die immediately. And they had like a song, and I don't remember the song, but it was like, don't pop your pimples in the T-zone.
Okay, so I am from Gilmanton Iron Works, New Hampshire. I went to the Gilmanton School, which goes, it's K-8. But these guys would come in with like exotic pets. It's like these are animals that you know, exist in the world, and some people have them as pets. And so there was like a ferret. But then the one that really got me was the African pygmy hedgehog. They're the hedgehogs that you can go on the internet and find like BuzzFeed articles, you know, listing how cute they are. And so they came in, and I was totally charmed, and I told my parents that I wanted a hedgehog. And they were like, okay. And they said, you can get a hedgehog, but you have to pay for it and you have to take care of it. And so I saved money as a third grader. I found a breeder in Blue Hill, Maine through a classified ad that someone clipped for me. And we drove up and bought a hedgehog for $50. And I had her for like 5 years. And it was genuinely heartbreaking when that animal died. And I will never have another hedgehog because it was so sad when she died. And that was because of an assembly.
Every year we would have the snake show. I don't know where they came from, but they basically, like, the school hired these, like, two, like, snake handler dudes. And the guys would come in with these, like, they look like the dog carriers, you know, and they would come in with like dozens of these dog carriers and they're just full of snakes. It's funny, thinking about it now, like all of this was so normal at the time. It's only strange in retrospect.
This was at what was then called Runlet Junior High School. Now it's Runlet Middle School here in Concord. So there may even be people out there who might remember this, but so we were all called to assembly and, you know, it was always inexplicable. Just suddenly you were called to assembly. And there was this stage set up with this band. And in my memory, they're all wearing, like, you know, white jumpsuits with rhinestone collars and handlebar mustaches and beards. And it was a rock band. And it was like a rock cover band. And I'm trying to remember. It was like Starwind or Starhawk or something like that. And the thing was, they were playing Supertramp songs. And I was like, are these the people who do this song? I just had no idea. I had no idea that there's a whole rung of talent who goes and does tours of junior high schools and does pop songs. At least they did in, you know, however long ago it was that I went to middle school. I just had no idea what was going on. So you think you're Romeo, playing a part in the picture show. Well, take the long way home. Take the long. Well, as inexplicable, ill-advised, or tone-deaf as some school assemblies can be, in some places, they border on the unconstitutional, crossing that sometimes blurry line between church and state. That's the charge made by Catherine Stewart in Slate, where she wrote about the connection between school assemblies and religiously affiliated groups. Catherine Stewart, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you so much for having me.
So we were all talking about some of the really bizarre assemblies that we saw in public school. And we're curious, how do speakers get booked by schools? Who decides? Who pays?
It works in different ways in different schools. Sometimes the administration invites them in. Sometimes it's a particular guidance counselor or a kind of teacher arranges it. Sometimes even, you know, a PTA member or the head of the PTA invites them in. And there are a range of topics, things like drunk driving, drug addiction, bullying, relationships and sex education. And these are obviously very useful topics. The challenge that we're seeing is that increasingly these assemblies are run by religious groups that really have their as their primary goal not to address the issue of, you know, drunk driving or anti-bullying, but really to kind of delivery sort of religion-driven idea of what constitutes an acceptable moral life.
Well, your article exposes a number of these religiously affiliated organizations and individuals speaking at assemblies. What are some of the topics that they have covered?
Well, I opened the article in Slate with an assembly by Jason Evert, who has an organization called the Chastity Project, and he was there to talk about sex and relationships and abstinence. And look, abstinence should always be an option and a respected option. But the problem here is that these programs are essentially saying it is the only option, and what they're doing is the opposite of what they're intended to do. It doesn't empower teens. It affirms instead the notion that girls who engage in intimacy are damaged and therefore unworthy of respect.
You also found some inaccuracies in some of the things that he was telling kids.
Well, a lot of inaccuracies. He cites very discredited studies showing the saying, for instance, that people who, you know, don't have intimacy until they get married have longer and happier marriages, et cetera, et cetera. Look, there's no room in what he's saying for people who choose to delay marriage. It doesn't have any room for people who decide not to marry or who have same-sex attraction.
Well, is this a stealth move? I mean, is there any indication of an organized movement or Christian group strategically targeting public schools?
Yes. Look, it's happening with increasing frequency. And I think the effort to preach in public schools does reflect change in the evangelical world. Not all of these programs are coming in from evangelical Christians. In my book, The Good News Club, I write about how some of the groups like the Kabbalah Center and the Scientologists are also have introduced in the past these kinds of assemblies and programs into the public schools. But the majority of these programs are coming in from evangelical Christian groups and a smattering of conservative Catholics. You know, in earlier times, missionaries focused their work or energy on unreached regions of the world. But in recent years, there's been this big change and interest in what they call backyard missionary work. And the focus here is on children in public schools, not just religious assemblies, but also quote-unquote Bible clubs such as Good News Clubs in the elementary level. At the high school level, you have organizations such as the Fellowship for Christian Athletes. Now, a group that's, you know, religious group that wants to meet after school and, you know, is truly student-led is not, you know, a problem in my view. But the problem is that a lot of these groups really try to bleed their activities into the normal school day, forcing all kids to take a stand. So they're not just targeting the kids who want to attend. They're targeting sort of all the kids.
Well, you've just laid out a number of things to pick up on. But what is the line between discriminating against religious groups and allowing them to present their point of view in schools?
Well, the challenge when religious groups are presenting their point of view in public schools, not all of the presentations are religious in nature. I was just speaking to a woman the other day in Abingdon, Virginia, who said that there was an anti-bullying lecture in her public school. Her daughter's in the third grade, and it was presented by a local church. They didn't really talk about God during the assembly, but all the kids were given a ticket to attend an event in their church and told, if you attend this event, we'll give you a free ticket to Disneyland. Yeah. So this is where the challenge is. A lot of the groups come in and they talk about these worthy topics like bullying or drunk driving. And at the end of the presentation, they invite the children to attend an event at their church. And that's where the proselytizing happens.
Catherine Stewart, she's a Slate contributor and author of The Good News Club. You'll find a link to read her Slate article on religious affiliations with public school assemblies. That's at wordofmouthradio.org. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott.
My name be Ice Cream 15 Star. My brother be Driver 18 Star. And my ghost brother, Mojack 5 Star, dead when I myself was only 6 years old.
Those are the opening lines of a remarkable book called The Country of Ice Cream Star by Sandra Newman, released last year to positive reviews and now out on paperback. The book is, as one critic put it, a sort of Hunger Games for grown-ups. And yet Newman's dystopian epic may have more in common with works like A Clockwork Orange or Ridley Walker, at least when it comes to the language. The entire novel is written from the perspective of a 15-year-old girl named Ice Cream Star, whose tribe speaks a lyrical and unique form of pidgin.
Most people, especially Americans, will immediately notice when they open the book that the language is really based on or strongly influenced by African-American vernacular English. But it isn't African-American vernacular English. It's my version of what might happen to African-American vernacular English if it were spoken only by children and teenagers who were constructing their own society in the absence of adults, of schools, of media, for roughly 100 years.
That's author Sandra Newman. The plot offers a little more context. In Ice Cream Star's world, a disease has wiped out most of the population. The only survivors are various tribes and communities of African American children, all of whom will also succumb to the mysterious illness called posies by their 21st birthdays. Ice Cream Star and her kind call themselves Sangles. And while they may not be able to explain their origins, Newman told us that they are descendants of Senegalese immigrants.
My mother and my grands and my great-grands been Sangle pure. Our people be a tarry night sort, and we skinny and long. My brother driver climb a tree with only hands, because our bones so light, our muscles 40 strong. We flee like a dragonfly over water. We fight like 10 guns, and we be bell to see. Other children go deranged and unpredictable for our love.
Maybe you were told in a high school or freshman English class to write what you know. That's not advice that Sandra Newman took to heart. So we asked what inspired her to write in a voice so utterly different from her own. Newman says she tried to outline the book in plain English, but it didn't work. When she started to toy with creating a language based on African-American vernacular and French Creole and biblical patois, the plot and tone of Ice Cream Star started to snap into place.
I thought this is a form of English that's familiar enough that it'll be comprehensible to people, but it's distinct enough. It actually has its own grammatical form, so there's that kind of feeling of real creativity in the way it's changed and informed itself. So I just wanted to look at it as a model, and as soon as I looked at it, I thought, this is beautiful. This is absolutely wonderful. And I didn't look at it again because I didn't want to imitate it. The next day, I sat down and wrote the first page of the book.
We Sangles be a wandering sort. We never grow nothing from anything. Never had no tato patch, no cornfield. Be thieves and braves to hunt. A Sangle hungry even when he eat. Even when he rich, he still want to grab, rob. He hungry for something he ain't never seen nor thought of. We was so proud. We was ridiculous as wild animals, but we was bell and strong.
Newman created her own dictionary as an aid while she wrote the book, which in the end wasn't all that useful. Often she would fish around for a word or phrase and then come up with something random that fit. Among the most versatile words in the country of Ice Cream Star is bone.
I come toward and say low voice, salut. Bon salut, say hey you.
Well, yeah, that one word, it essentially means good. To a French speaker, it's obviously from French, so... But it's spelled like the bone that you have in your body. So it means good, but it also, you know, it can just be an emphasizer, like be bone disgusting means is really disgusting. And there are a lot of other words that are like that, that either drift into the meaning of really, you know, like in contemporary teenage slang, like hella or something. So the word valley, which essentially means courageous or brave, also can be used in that same way to mean really. Or, again, like many slang words in teen speak, a lot of words just drift into the meaning of cool. Valley can mean cool. Fury can mean cool. Wolfen can mean cool. And, you know, you just see from the context when it's being used that way.
Did it always come naturally to you when you were writing in this language?
That's our producer, Taylor Quimby, who picks it up from here.
Or were there times where you, like, had to go back and rewrite something that you had already done because you lost it for a little bit?
I would know when I was getting it wrong, and I would just be listening sort of to myself, trying to come up with sentences that were right for the language. Just as when you're speaking a foreign language and you're at that middle point where you speak it, but you don't sound like a native. You're trying to sound like a native and fit in. So it was sort of like that process of trying to fit into the culture and pass for a Sangle in my own book.
Salut. Bon salut, say hey you. Driver get his brother face. Slept far my ice, the morning meal be by. Nay, been away and back. I come and hunker to the fire, its woody breath come to my nose. Driver reach and touch my head. Hair grow beyond its braids, be some old centipedes you got. I shake my braids to shoo him, smile up weak. Sure, I look like any rotten log, male's gonna fear.
Well, really the hardest thing is exposition. You know, like when I'm trying to explain the history of a city, for instance. So it's difficult to do that in literature anyway without it becoming boring and beginning to feel a little bit flat and factual. So if you're doing it in this dialect, which is already, you know, just a little hard to understand, you have to keep it even shorter because it's more of a task and therefore it has even more of a risk of becoming tiresome. So those parts would take me days and days to write a paragraph. And then I would get into my favorite thing to write of all is fight scenes, which I could just write pages of those all day long without getting tired, so.
Without thinking sense, I shoot. Yo, every child be shooting wild. Ain't aiming, only shoot, like slapping a stinging wasp in panic. Be along a second before I know, Kalash got safety on. Ain't rid no bullet. And I fall hasty, claw her switch with weirdo fingers, strange to use. See a child laying on his face, his neck torn through, blood be moving, kicking from his wound. A girl crouch by him, rise again with blood in hands and awful face, shout high and vicious, Eddie's dead.
What do you think a constructed language does in terms of changing the experience for the reader? How does that change the experience of reading a book, and maybe how does it add value if you think it does?
Well, I think it can add value. It doesn't always. I'm not a big fan of the section of Cloud Atlas that's written in an invented language. It didn't work for me. But I think in Ridley Walker or in Clockwork Orange, almost all readers who read those books find that it adds value. And for me, you know, obviously it makes it more difficult initially to read it, but it also adds an aesthetic quality to the language, much in the same way that if you go to Ireland, the Irish accent and Irish idioms add an aesthetic quality to everyday life. So it's just everyday life, but it has this sort of beauty and strangeness to it. And also because it sort of sinks you into that world in a really deep way. So there's a kind of intense escapism about it, which I think you can't really achieve as quickly and powerfully in any other way.
Days that come been clean bonus. We keep to 495, a highway broad as any field. Got a twin highway the same, these two companion faithful. Together, they go stretch and snake across all unkept distance till they find our new Connecticut. Some places, both roads vanish, eaten by the growing wild. Look like the highway dived beneath a cliff of skinny trees. We see a road sign stood peculiar in a flock of birch, a lonely patch of road remaining stubborn like a mushroom. Then, without no visible cause, the highway start again, with only nibbling bush around its edge.
I've found in the past that when I read anything, especially that's written in dialect, that assuming that there's nobody around to hear me, I have a tendency to want to read it aloud to myself, to hear myself say it, to sort of make it that much more real. Did you ever do that sort of thing?
You know, I didn't, and that's because I cannot make it sound correct to myself. I'm terrible at accents. I'm actually a terrible actress. I attempted to be an actress when I was a teenager, so I know this for a fact. I'm a terrible actress. And it's interesting because we've just signed rights for an audio version of the book, and they sent over the first file of the narrator they've hired, and she's so much better than I am. She sounds so much more right for the book than I do when I do readings. It's terrible. It's really embarrassing how badly I read my own invented language.
Author Sandra Newman there, speaking with Taylor Quimby when The Country of Ice Cream Star first came out last year. It's now available in paperback and on audiobook. All the excerpts from the novel were read by Logan Shannon. And you can find much more about the book at wordofmouthradio.org. If you're a regular listener to Word of Mouth, you know you can hear it live on NHPR or whenever you want, online or by downloading the Word of Mouth podcast. Well, we're inviting you to listen to another podcast that we're calling the 10-Minute Writer's Workshop. It's a quick hit from behind the scenes and inside the minds of acclaimed and emerging authors. We ask them about their process and habits and their suggestions for aspiring writers. Today, Megan Abbott, whose 2014 novel The Fever landed on a number of best of the year lists, and who was called by one critic, David Lynch, for teenagers.
This is Megan Abbott, and this is the 10-Minute Writer's Workshop.
Which for you is harder to write, the first sentence or the last?
Oh, definitely the first sentence. The first sentence, often that's the thing that stalls me for days, weeks on end, because it's so much the pressure of really believing that this is the book, this is the story I should be telling. The last sentence tends to write itself. It kind of spills out there at the end, and it's almost always the right one right off, which it rarely is in the first sentence.
Do you have any famous or well-known or favorite first sentences in your mind?
Oh, I think I really love The Great Gatsby, you know, in my younger and more vulnerable years is a favorite. There's so many great scary book ones. There's several Shirley Jackson ones that always ring in my head. The first line is so important. I know particularly literary agents who sometimes stop reading if the first line isn't good.
Oh.
So no pressure there for all of us.
Well, actually, that leads me to how many times were you rejected before getting published?
Not that many times, though. I've been rejected a lot since. My first time out, I was lucky to get an agent pretty quickly. And I sent a query out to maybe half a dozen agents, and I just got lucky. And I think I assumed that it would just go that way thereafter after my whole experience in publishing. Everything would be yes, yes, yes. But it was not that way. It is sort of a long distance marathon.
Are there any personal habits that you'd encourage other writers to take up or maybe to avoid in order to be more productive?
I would say to avoid, though I don't always avoid it, would be not to be too precious with a novel, with every sentence other than that first one, because it really becomes the excuse not to write anything. And I know writers who've polished the same 40 pages of the beginning of a novel for years. And ones I think I would adopt is that to read everything you can get your hands on that's somewhat in the world of the book you want to write. I think that's so important. And sometimes you might have to stop at a certain point and put that down. But I think reading everything you can get your hands on is foremost.
What is your personal worst distraction that keeps you from getting work done?
Oh, God, social media. It's awful. It gives and it takes away. You know, writing is a lonely profession, and you spend so much time alone. There's something kind of wonderful about things like Twitter, because there's all these other, you know, lonely writers out there and regular people that are not crazy. And so it becomes this delight. It can be very invigorating, but goodness knows, it's the time suck of all time.
You're pretty robust with your Twitter handle anyway.
I am. I really enjoy it far too much. I feel like I've developed these virtual friendships with a lot of other people. It is a great way to talk to readers. And I love following some of my favorite writers on there. To get a little bit of their personality is kind of delightful.
Well, so when you get off your social media and you get back to it, do you edit as you go or do you generally wait to the end to edit and why?
I edit as I go. I don't know any other way. It's not necessarily purposeful, but I always go back several pages before I start again each day. And so I end up editing throughout because of that. I have to go back to sort of go forward. So that becomes a big thing. I don't do a heavy edit until after the book is done, but I do a lot of paragraph sentence editing as I go.
How much research do you do before you start, or do you do that as you go along?
Both, but a lot before I start. Almost all my books have some basis in reality or a real life event, so I tend to be inspired by research, by reading something in the newspaper, and then sort of following the tendrils outward. And I like to write in worlds that I'm not familiar with. So that's sort of part of the pleasure for me.
What's the best environment for writing for you?
Oh, almost always. I have two places I write, and I can't write any other place, which is my office at home and this writer's space I go to in Manhattan, which is completely silent and in this old creaky building with mice. So those are they're both really a dank kind of quiet places, and I do better there.
What do you think is the most common mistake that new writers make?
I think sometimes they're trying to write what they think will be successful, what, you know, I want to write the next Gone Girl, when, you know, whatever is the big book out now, like Girl on a Train, you know, I need to do that rather than following your passion, which, I mean, it sounds like a cliche, but most cliches are cliches because they're true, and that's one of them. If you don't, the book, it'll read like a book that was written to become a bestseller, and no one really likes to read those.
Are there books that you would recommend that people do read as tools to learn about writing?
I don't read many of them, but when I've taught writing, I've used many of them because I know some writers find them really useful. I think the Stephen King book on writing is great. I love to read writers' journals. Sometimes I'll read Sylvia Plath's journals or other writers that were sort of compulsive diarists, because then you kind of get in their head, and I find that maybe more helpful than a how-to book.
What's the best piece of advice you ever received about writing?
Boy, don't censor yourself and don't judge yourself and don't judge your characters, which is, I guess, three pieces of advice, but I see them all together. Especially the third one, don't judge your characters, which I think is easy to do, especially because your readers will. I know I judge characters, but I think you have to go into the book loving them all, even the darker ones, or they won't feel real to the reader. You have to be interested in all their dark corners.
Well, Megan Abbott, thank you so much for speaking with us today.
Oh, it was so much fun. Such a pleasure.
Megan Abbott, author of Dare Me, The Fever, and the forthcoming You Will Know Me, which is due to be published in July. This episode of the 10-Minute Writers Workshop was produced by Sarah Plourd. You can hear plenty more from the series by subscribing to the podcast on iTunes. And if you like it, please write a review. It's a great way to share creativity and a lot cheaper, easier, and faster than getting into that prestigious program in Iowa. Depending on the source, Mount Fuji in Japan or New Hampshire's Mount Monadnock is the most climbed mountain in the world. The latter claim could be somewhat apocryphal, but anyone who's trekked up Monadnock on a good day might agree. In addition to hikers and naturalists, Monadnock has inspired works by artists Abbott Thayer and Richard Whitney, writers from Ralph Waldo Emerson to H.P. Lovecraft, along with countless weekend painters and tourists. A pair of New Hampshire artists has assembled 100 views of Monadnock from that most pedestrian of memorials, the postcard. 100 Views of Mount Monadnock is an installation by Corwin Levi and Michelle Aldridge, and it opens in Harrisville this weekend, along with a performance by Katie Lohmiller. The public event is billed as a Guarlingo salon, and we're talking with founder and curator Michelle Aldridge. Hello, Michelle.
Hi, Virginia. Thanks for having me.
So glad you're here. I know you're putting things up right now. You're working on the installation. But why postcards?
Why postcards? I think they are such an interesting cultural relic. I look at Mount Monadnock every day from my house, and it's an ever-present thing. And we kept thinking about how could we work with this amazing mountain and memorialize it in some way. And the postcard came to us as just this everyday object that tourists and locals alike used, and we began to collect.
So where do you find them?
Well, eBay has been our best friend. They're surprisingly hard to find locally. We found a few at shops, and but we have a couple of eBay alerts set up. So every morning I would get up and I would check my alerts and see what new Monadnock postcards were available. And we had one restraint, which was that the card had to be used. So we wanted something that was postmarked and had a message on it.
Wow, so they all have messages. How do you show them front and back for your show?
So we are actually excerpting one sentence from each card. And I actually got out my old trusty typewriter and some old library card catalog cards and sat down and typed up 100 cards. And so we will be showing the card, and beneath it will be an excerpt of our favorite sentence that's on the back.
What are some that stick out to you now? Do you remember any?
Oh, yeah, there's some really good ones. So ladies commenting on the how overwhelmed they are by the climb. I only went as far as the hotel, for I dared not climb the last half. And then we have a really great quote. I love this one. This is from a woman. This is 1908. So this is a time when women didn't wear pants. She's writing to a friend and saying how sorry she was that she wasn't able to meet her. And she said, "I wanted to pick blackberries so much, I bought a pair of pants." And she was disappointed not to be able to wear her pants. There's a lot of messages about driving automobiles and how exciting that is. It's clearly a novelty. I also love that you'll get cards that say, don't have time to write, but we'll write soon. And that's written on a card, but emphasizing that a longer letter was forthcoming. So this was clearly the primary form of communication for many people.
Yeah, so which years do you span here?
We have started, I think our first card is 1900, and then we go up to 1995. And it's interesting because they become harder to find once you hit the 60s, like the 70s, 80s, and 90s were particularly challenging. In fact, we do not have a card from the 80s, so if any of your listeners have a postmarked Monadnock card from the 80s they would like to send to us, we would be grateful.
Michelle Aldridge, get back to work. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Virginia.
Michelle Aldridge is artist and curator of the Guarlingo website and salons. 100 Views of Mount Monadnock is an installation by Michelle and Corwin Levi, and it's opening Friday at Storehouse 41. That's on Main Street in Harrisville. You'll find more on the salon and Perception. That's the performance by Katie Lowmiller, by going to wordofmouthradio.org. Thanks so much for taking some time to listen today. We do invite you to share what you heard with others. You can go to wordofmouthradio.org for a deep list of segments to listen to, post on social media, or email to friends. We're on Facebook at Word of Mouth Radio and on Twitter at Word of Mouth. And let us know what you're curious about, the stories and sources you find interesting, or what's scratching at your sense of wonder. We find the best stories tend to bounce around by word of mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott, encouraging you to share those ideas. Until next time, this is Word of Mouth from NHPR.